Welcome to Never Forget Radio. This podcast was honored to be selected to perform at the Philadelphia Podcast Festival, arranged by the Philadelphia Podcasting Society, which was held in August 2014 at Tattooed Moms on South Street in Philadelphia. The performance that follows hinges on the 100th anniversary of World War I, which began in August 1914, and on this quote from Theses on the Philosophy of History, written by German-Jewish historian Walter Benjamin in 1940, describing a Paul Klee painting from 1920, which we've amended to better reflect the universality and unlimited gender possibility of the character that Benjamin imagined.
A Paul Klee painting named Angelus Novus shows an angel looking as though they are about to move away from something they are fixedly contemplating. Their eyes are staring, their mouth is open, their wings are spread. This is how one pictures the angel of history. Zay's face is turned toward the past. Where we perceive a chain of events, Zay sees one single catastrophe which keeps piling wreckage upon wreckage and hurls it in front of their feet. The angel would like to stay, awaken the dead, and make whole what has been smashed. But a storm is blowing from paradise. It has got caught in her wings with such violence that the angel can no longer close them. The storm irresistibly propels them into the future, to which their back is turned, while the pile of debris before them grows skyward. This storm is what we call progress.
Oh, it's so hard to remember.
Welcome to Never Forget Radio, where, from the comfort of your own home or your device, and from the safety of the future, we can revisit the memory of 9/11, of George W. Bush, and of all the years associated with both since. It's been over a decade of disappointment, failure, and disaster. I'm no expert, but I'll be your host as we explore our recent past and try to reclaim it. Let's roll.
The United States is bombing Iraq again. This week, for obvious reasons, this podcast is obsessed with Iraq. And this year, this death's head anniversary, this round-numbered headstone, this century of slaughter, throughout 2014, this podcast has been subject to continual loomings about 1914. In this foreboding year, I would have seized on any signs of recurrence of this war or continuation to write prose poetry about the trenches. I would have done that anyway, but I didn't expect that these things would be connected, World War I and Iraq, connected so obviously, not just in Western portrayals as much as in the statements of the insurgents themselves. Today, 100 years after World War I, the Islamic State, which is also known as ISIS or ISIL, Islamic State, these insurgents in eastern Syria and western Ukraine, these insurgents in eastern Syria and western Iraq, their stated goal, besides establishing a compulsive theocracy, their stated goal is to overturn the Sykes-Picot secret agreement between Imperial England and Imperial France during World War I. After they defeated the Ottoman Empire, these two European empires segmented the Middle East between themselves into French and English territories instead of granting local sovereignty. And these people who are rebelling against the Syrian government now, the Iraq government now, who beheaded an American like 2 days ago, they're very mad about the partition that these Europeans cut right through an ethnic enclave. when they divided the area into colonies. France got what's now Syria, Britain got what's now Iraq, and this ethnic group who lived there got nothing. This is not the first border we will break. We will break many borders, they say in their official YouTube propaganda video called End of Sykes-Picot. According to these publicity documents, according to what they say, not including to some American narrative, these people are still fighting today, World War I, 100 years later. Eurocentric narratives about the war focus on the Western Front, the big empires, Britain, France, Germany. All I remember learning about the Ottoman Empire is this famous quote from the 19th century, "The Ottoman Empire is the sick man of Europe." This is all I remember learning about, this dismissive quote. "The Ottoman Empire is the sick man of Europe." That would make Britain, France, and Germany healthy empires, and Russia and Austria unwell empires, empires with bad posture, like empires who ate bad fish. Like, not sick exactly, but suspect, latent turmoil. So the fitter, stronger empires made secret agreements to carve up the sick, weak ones into new colonies and puppet states and buffer zones and spheres of influence. When I use all these phrases continue and uphold the legitimacy of the power hierarchy that used them, even 100 years later. Spheres of influence, puppet states, these legitimize over-the-top power, a power from down to below. Even the idea of an empire with food poisoning, even the idea of an empire with food poisoning legitimates the idea of an empire at all. All empires are sick men. Not just the Ottomans, the British, the Germans, the Americans, all must repress the political left and minority groups to retain control. All are economically fragile, dependent on colonies and unequal labor systems. All their rituals and uniforms and rites of masculinity and flags and songs mask rotten domestic systems, bankrupt or ineffectual health and education, desperate disparity of wealth, lack of concern for their populations. All empires are a depression away from revolution and a big external war away from a quick restoration of false stability. All empires are sick men. But it's so enticing to use that language that I have to. Sick empires. Iraq has had a lot of experience with this sick system. The sick Ottoman Empire ruled for several hundred years before they were overturned by the sick British Empire, which was a colonial power there until the mid-50s. There was a coup. Then there was a brief period of local rule in Iraq, but it was in a dictatorial form. And the American Empire came in to Iraq actually in the 1980s. There's a picture of Donald Rumsfeld shaking hands with Saddam Hussein. This is when America and Iraq were allied against the Iranians. I've even read that the Islamic State has imperial ambitions. It's declared itself a caliphate, the heir to the pan-Islamic empire that the Ottomans supplanted. Now I want to go to a very familiar film set in our sick empire, about the divide between an empire and its disassociated citizens. And it's also the most well-known film we have about Iraq. Perhaps actually, as Americans, we don't have a lot of images about the Middle East or Middle Eastern history or American history in the Middle East. So I kind of think that this film, which I'm presuming you've all seen, is the most well-known American film about Iraq. And that's The Big Lebowski.
Now, this here story I'm about to unfold took place back in the early 90s, just about the time of our conflict with Saddam and the Iraqis. The only only mention it because sometimes there's a man. I won't say a hero, because what's a hero? But sometimes there's a man, and I'm talking about the dude here.
Well, there you have it. This is a fake noir film about not a hero exactly, but an ex-hippie accidental detective and his Vietnam veteran best friend, and it's narrated by a cowboy. It's a parody of films that were set in the 40s and 50s, noir films, but it's a period piece that was filmed in 1998 and set in Los Angeles in 1991. A lot of ins, a lot of outs. If you haven't seen this film, that was a pretty good introduction, I think. Also, I apologize for assuming that anyone who would attend a podcast festival would have seen this film. Since its release, it's become a huge cult film, popular in you, in this audience, I think. People have very strong, fond attachments to The Big Lebowski, and you can kind of write your own interpretations about it. Most people's interpretations are about the bowling and the smoking and the porn. But for me, it's a film about Iraq and the Gulf War. But even more than that, this is a film for me, The Big Lebowski, about the relationship that Americans have with our government's wars. One of my favorite things about this movie is that all the characters borrow words from each other. They continually repeat things that other characters have said, even without noticing. The most obvious interpretation of this pattern is that most of the characters are stoners, or fools, or Brandt, who has his own problems. But I think there's a deeper meaning than that these characters are stoners or really sad for this repetition. Lebowski in particular, the dude, the hero, protagonist, detective of this film, he keeps repeating things that other characters have said. His brain is unwittingly replicating under the level of conscious thought. There are several instances of this happening.
To use the parlance of our times.
You know, a young trophy wife in the parlance of our times, you know.
Her life is in your hands.
Her life was in our hands, man!
Mr. Lebowski asked me to repeat that.
Her life was in your hands!
Her life is in your hands.
Shit.
Her life is in your hands, dude.
This was also, I tried to make that clip a summary of the film, if you haven't seen it. Her life was in your hands. There's a kidnapping, but it's a fake kidnapping. Anyway, all the characters continually repeat things that each other have said. And in the first scene of the movie, before he even has a line in the movie opens with narration. Before he even has a line, Lebowski is buying milk in the supermarket, and we see George Bush, the president, on the television. And he's the one, actually, who has the first line in the film. And then later in the movie, Lebowski's subconscious spits this line back out.
This will not stand. This will not stand, this aggression against Kuwait.
This will not stand, you know? This aggression will not stand, man.
So here we have Lebowski repeating the president's threat, essentially, threat to Saddam Hussein. The president's aggression, as well as Saddam's, and it's—he's a—you know—his brain is addled. Like it works in circles. It makes sense that he repeats things on the level of a character, but on the level of the film, I think that this pattern, which all the characters show, is a great metaphor for how America's imperial wars and violent outlook towards the rest of the world filter into our daily lives and conversations, even without knowing it, even without us being consciously aware of it. Even if we're lucky enough for them to not manifest in our daily lives, war and violence are an unavoidable part of our internal lives. Lebowski doesn't engage with the war in his daily life, but his traumatic lurking presence is with him at night. In one of his dream sequences, Saddam Hussein appears to him at night in his dream, replacing a bowling alley attendant who he sees every day. And Saddam is on the television every day, and Lebowski sees this bowling attendant every day, and in his unconscious mind has merged them. The war is seeping into his head. Both presences in his background world are equally there, like the war on television and like figurant people, like people you see every day on the street but don't really notice. That's what the character that Saddam replaces in Lebowski's dream is. It's just this figurant on the margins of his life, but always there. That's what the war is like for these characters in 1991, and for us, of course. In the film, there's all this Pulp Fiction going on. Like characters have sex and they shoot porn films and they throw their underwear off bridges and they talk about their rashes. They eat corporate hamburgers. But the entire time there's a war on. The Gulf War established a new narrative paradigm for Western war. The wars were now extremely removed from the everyday lives of the citizens, the privileged citizens of the empire, bloodless, fake, clean, ignorable, avoiding the Vietnam scenario where what was intended to be a small war became too publicly big and went on too long, and people of valued demographics resisted it. This is the last thing that a warmongering power system wants. They want compliant bowling people to just kind of let the war wash through their lives. But even if we ignore the wars while they go on, they do. And we definitely don't hear about them after they end. But wars don't really end. Our interest in them ends. Our paying attention to them ends. The news about them ends. The narrative says the war ended in 1918. The war ended in 1975. The war ended in 1991. But in terms of trauma and in terms of causal blowback, wars don't end. World War I never ended for ISIS. Vietnam never ended for Walter Sobchak. And as for the Gulf War, Al-Qaeda and bin Laden declared that one of their reasons for attacking America was the stationing of American troops in Saudi Arabia for the invasion of Iraq during the Gulf War. And the remaining, the keeping stationed of those troops in Saudi Arabia permanently after the war, really incensed these, I guess you would call them far-right theocrats. American troops were just left in Saudi Arabia to possibly invade Iraq again, just in case those people ever came back into power in 2000. Wars don't end. Why start a new one when we have so many going on already? This month is August 2014, 100 years after the beginning of World War I, would seem to be a pretty inauspicious time to start a war. But here we are, the U.S. bombing ISIS installations in Iraq, considering drone strikes in Syria, committing further support, monetarily and arms, to the Iraqi government and the Kurdish government, neither of which get along, and sending just a few so far, those most evocative troops, non-combatant advisors, to return to the country and guard American installations and protect dams and oil fields and civilians trapped on a mountain. How soon before escalation, mission creep, and a third war? Well, one thing that's come down to us about World War I is that the people went down to the trenches because they were led astray by bad leaders, kings and autocrats who made poor decisions, who were trapped by their treaties, who made poor decisions and led them to war. And if only they had made the right decisions, we would have avoided all of this. So by that logic, maybe if we had new leaders, they'd make better choices in foreign policy. I remember when I thought this was true during the full-scale war in Iraq during the Bush administration. I thought perhaps new leaders would make better decisions and we would have less wars in the Middle East. But I don't think that this war started any of these wars from bad leaders making bad decisions. It was bad states, sick men, sick empires that were not about their people, run by a small number of aristocrats and top men, playing strategy games in which their people were just another resource to be leveraged, wagered, consumed. People who grew up going to war museums, just running these foreign policies. Rather than being rash, these leaders actually made quite rational decisions as per what they were and who they were. Because at a certain point, that thread of power like Chekhov's gun must be used. Otherwise, it's worthless. A projector that shows nothing for 20 minutes has to show something. If the president is considering a range of strike options, he will pick some. If you give cops military equipment, they will use it militarily. And Brinksmen engaging in brinksmanship will at some point go over the brink. You don't have to go to the war museum to find a war. You can find it in your favorite films, lurking at the margins of them, hidden in the background, unremarked, into the minds of the characters. You can find it in your dreams and semi-conscious thoughts, day residue from half-processed images and reports and news headlines that you didn't read or even come close to clicking on. You can find it walking down the street, up grimy stone steps and forgotten monuments where only punks and street people sit. You can find it somewhere on the walls in street art and graffiti. You might find it on your block if you live in or near an area that is not valued by the state. If you live in Missouri, if you live in the Bronx, in Brooklyn. A few months ago, plainclothes police shot an unarmed black man 2 blocks from where I live in West Philadelphia. And, of course, there's something that's hidden even farther in The Big Lebowski because it takes place in 1991 in Los Angeles. In a different part of LA in that year, the police beat an unarmed man, Rodney King, on camera over and over on the ground. Different part of the city, I think. You can find the war on a Sunday afternoon in a sunny day in a dark room or on a bright blue cloudless morning out of nowhere. Whatever it is, you find it. If you call it World War I or the Gulf War or a police riot or the first, second, or third war in Iraq, in whatever form it comes, it'll be looked over by Walter Benjamin's Angel of History, who sees one single catastrophe piling wreckage upon wreckage at its feet. Thank you, and never forget.
Never Forget Radio is a production of Bookstyle Publications, currently based in West Philadelphia. Music for this episode is by Old Table. Thanks to the Philadelphia Podcast Festival, Tattooed Mom, Gatsby, Nathan Karuna, Keegan Keating, Andrew Keller, Sammy Schuster, and Rebecca Catherine Hirsch.
Special thanks also to Ben Pasternak for coming here. And Corey Bickelly, who's running a projector. And Eli Schuster Bickelly, who's here somewhere.
Send your World War I prose poetry to Never Forget Radio on iTunes, Facebook, Gmail, Bandcamp, or Tumblr, or Never Forget Pod on Twitter. And there are also flyers and hand-drawn maps on the gear-shaped table back there. Check them out. And today we have two quotes. The first quote is from Dick Cheney in 2003, who said, quote, "From the standpoint of the Iraqi people, my belief is we will be greeted as liberators." And the second quote is from British General Stanley Maude from his proclamation to the people of Baghdad in 1917. He says, quote, "Our armies do not come into your cities and lands as conquerors or enemies, but as liberators." Thank you, and never forget.